This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. What's that got to do with the price of tea in China? That expression shows the typical attitude. What difference does it make? What happens in China? Well, last week, markets in China crashed twice. The second time, investors were in such a frenzy that authorities shut the markets down after they'd only been open for 14 minutes. Amazingly, this economic problem in China resonated all over the world. Markets have been in turmoil ever since, and trillions of dollars of wealth have evaporated. Did you realize that what happens in China was so important? We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Robert Morley about what happened in China this past week, why it's so concerning to investors around the world, and how it will impact you, and where this situation could lead. There is a real battle developing in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The last couple of weeks have seen a lot of headlines showing just how desperate Saudi Arabia is to try to check Iran's rise. And Iran is firing back with some provocative responses of its own. Very interesting effects resulting from America's decision in recent years to turn its back on Saudi Arabia and to treat Iran as an ally. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal is going to give us more information about this developing situation. The most regularly consumed food in the world is bread. But bread has gotten some bad press lately with concern over carbs and gluten. Is bread still okay to include as part of your diet? And if so, what kind? We're going to talk with Jorg Mardian, a registered holistic nutritionist, to help us answer this question. And we'll conclude the show today with a few words about the importance of every small step you take. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Global markets are in turmoil. The Dow is down, the DAX is down, the FTSE is down in London, commodities are down, oil is down, bonds are down. And really, it all started last week in China. China's markets crashed two times. Authorities shut them down. And we really got a picture of just how important China has become to the global economy. I have the Trumpet's financial analyst, Robert Morley, here to talk about this. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
So why don't we start by you just giving us a picture of the current situation as you see it?
Sure. So last week were some pretty dramatic days on Wall Street and around the world. You could say a lot of traders were in panic mode. A lot of these investors, international investors, were probably glued to their computer screens as they saw trillions of dollars evaporate in a matter of minutes. I think that second trading day in China, when they shut markets on Thursday, it was the shortest trading day in their market's history. It only took 14 minutes and 17 seconds before authorities stepped in and shut things down and said, hey, we got, hold on here. There's panic in the markets. We need to stop. And over that short period of time between Thursday and then on Tuesday, when they shuttered those markets, about $2 trillion worth of wealth had evaporated.
From these other markets?
Well, $2 trillion in wealth from the United States market evaporated, but probably a similar amount in Europe. Nowhere to exist anymore. In China, probably somewhat less than that, but for the Chinese market, which is smaller, an even greater proportion of the wealth probably disappeared. So there was a lot of panic in markets.
And because of what China, what happened in that 14 minutes and in the preceding days?
That's right. The world markets were queuing off of China. They were taking their cues off of what was going on thousands of miles around the world. It wasn't the United States that was leading markets. It wasn't the United States that was driving investor sentiment. It was panic and worry about what was happening in China. But it spread, and it spread very rapidly around the world. As you mentioned, virtually everything was in the red last week, whether it was oil prices or commodities. It was dramatic down, and that goes back to China.
So we've got two stories here in a sense. One is just the massive ripple effects that we see emanating out of China and just what a powerhouse this has become and how much a problem in China can just have a dramatic impact elsewhere. The other issue is what's going on in China that's causing this. Why don't we start with that?
Sure. Well, if you take a look at China, they are in drastic industrial production decline. If you look at their production numbers. They've been down for the last seven out of the last 8 months in a row. I think 7 out of the last 9 months, their production numbers have been falling. So manufacturing is continuing to contract in China. And because of that, their payroll numbers are coming down. And China is a very unstable place in some ways. They have a growing middle class and a wealth class on the coasts. But there's still millions of Chinese every year are migrating from the interior to the coast, and they're looking for jobs and they're looking for employment, and they want what they see on the televisions now, they see in the Western world. So there's a lot of people that are after a standard of living. And in China, if they aren't producing those jobs over there, there can be a lot of instability and chaos. And if you look at China, the numbers aren't very good at all. And that's really reflected in the commodity markets, which have just crashed over the last year. If you take a look at, we've talked about oil prices, they're down 41% last year. If you look at industrial metals, I think they were down on average 24% last year. But some, like iron ore, which is really a reflection of China, how much China is manufacturing, the automotive industry and others, they were down pretty big as well, probably closer to 50%. Grains were down. Even precious metals were down last year. And a lot of this is going to China. But
that's amazing. That's amazing. The fact that China's contraction would have that much impact on so many different commodity markets.
Well, China is the manufacturing center of the world today. That was America back in the post-World War II era. Well, that has shifted now. China is the manufacturing house of the world. China is the world's largest exporter. Its products are going around the world more than any other nation in the world. And when China slows down, that's a reflection of the global economy.
And commodity prices being in the basement, this has ripple effects all over the place as well. This is part of the reason why a Chinese contraction would have such a massive impact on all these other markets.
Absolutely. Australia, incredibly tied to China. They're starting to feel it in their commodity markets. They're not selling what they were to China. There's ghost towns popping up all over Australia where these boom towns that have grown up over the last 15 years, houses are selling for a dollar. Nobody wants them. The mines are gone. And there's no employment. So China is having a lot of ripple effects around the world as it's slowing down. You can look at some of these numbers that just show how trade has slowed down. You can look at the Baltic Dry Index, which measures the price of ship dry goods around the world, or the ocean-going cargo, the rates charged for the cargo ships, the ocean-going ships. They're all at near record lows. And some of that is just that we have a lot of these new vessels that were built in the boom days, and there's just incredible amounts of excess capacity out there. And the other side of it is that China just isn't producing as much as it was a couple of years ago. It's slowing down. So trade is slowing down today.
Now, we're talking about contraction within China. How much of it is it really a contraction, or is it just a slowing in the rate of growth?
Great question. I think you nailed it. It is a slowing of growth. People talk about China contracting. What they really mean is that China used to grow at 10% a year. More recently, they've been growing at 7% a year. Now analysts are worried it might be growing at 4% a year. So to give you a little context on that, policymakers in the United States are thrilled when we grow at 2% a year. Mm-hmm. We're not growing at 2% a year. We're growing at sub 2%, probably 1.5, 1.6, something like that, according to Fed numbers. So you're right. When we talk about China contracting, they're still growing. They're still producing more jobs than they have in the past. They're still, their economy is expanding, just not at those rates that the world is used to.
So how else can we contextualize this? I mean, we're seeing problems in China that are having these effects in other markets. What's the long-term prognosis for China, given the fact that its industrial base is so strong, that it is such a producer, it is such an exporter?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of those things you just mentioned, manufacturing, those are foundations of economies. And if you look at where the wealth in America came from, that was all built on manufacturing back in the pre-World War I, World War II era. We're seeing those industries that really made America great, they've offshored. They're over in Asia, not just in China, but in other Asian countries as well. And China is building that foundation. They are rapidly modernizing, and we are seeing that.
And they're also a lender nation.
They are. That's right. They're a net creditor nation to this world. They're the United States' most important lender, right? We owe China somewhere in the realm of $3 trillion. If you start looking at all the offshore banking centers, it might be more than that. China has, it likes to hide how much it's actually lending to other nations around the world. But when you look at the Caribbean banking centers, you look at like Luxembourg, you look at even Great Britain. Great Britain's become a bit of a proxy for Chinese lenders. They go through Great Britain. It could be more than that. So trillions of dollars.
So if we're looking at, say, the benchmark, the markers that would really indicate long-term health in an economy, China's a whole lot better off than most nations out there, certainly better than the United States.
Well, the interesting thing about the United States is if you look at, you know, the fundamentals, if you look at American geography, if you look at American technology, we have a lot of things going for the United States, China, in many ways, is at a disadvantage. And that's what I find so interesting about this is that over the last several decades, we've seen this huge shift. It's despite all these economic advantages and geographical advantages the United States has.
Bad policy is able to trump all that.
Right. Bad policy is able to trump all of that. And you can see that reflected in even things as simple as the U.S. national debt, the federal debt. You know, we've seen that double over the last 8 years. By the time President Obama leaves office, we'll be at $20 trillion. I mean, this is the biggest amount of debt anybody in the history of the world has ever had.
Right. It's almost like the professional football player who's making so many millions of dollars a year and somehow his career ends and he's penniless.
And he's bankrupt. America's facing the same thing. It's interesting. We just had last week Richard Fisher. He was a former head of the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas. And he came out and he was warning and saying, we've blown this. The Federal Reserve has blown this bubble. In America, we've front loaded the markets basically by slashing interest rates to zero, by printing up money. We've created a speculative bubble in the markets, and we did this on purpose and we did this knowingly because this was how we were going to bring America out of the last great recession that happened in 2008. But now he's looking ahead and saying, what's going to happen over these next couple of years? There's always cause and effect. And he said, you know, in one scenario, we might just have a flattening of the markets as the economy catches up. If everything goes well, this is what we're hoping for. But we might also see a big market crash if things don't go that way, because we've pulled forward all this demand that would have been, you know, happening now. We've pulled that forward and that's already juiced the markets. So now we're in a very precarious spot. And it was very sobering because Federal Reserve officials don't talk like that normally. Now, he just recently retired. I think it's given him a little bit more room to speak. And he was a hawk. He was speaking out against these policies as much as he could during that time period. But just getting back to your point, policy can destroy a lot of the natural geographic and otherwise, you know, benefits that are working for a nation.
And the point you're making is that China has been able to grow the way that it has in spite of disadvantages that would have worked against such an expansion.
Yeah, the Chinese miracle is something that a lot of people have talked about. And a part of it is America building up China as well. There's been a lot of American money that has gone to China. It's, you know, been our corporations that are looking at the 1.2 billion Chinese and seeing dollar signs and have done a lot to build up China. So it's not something that necessarily Chinese have done on their own. They haven't, but it's the world sees a massive market in China, and they've been very willing to go over there and build China up to get access to that market.
So specifically, what are some of the pressures on the Chinese economy right now that are creating some of these problems?
Well, China has grown very, very fast. The stock market has zoomed as well. And China has not, what we've seen the central banks do around this world over the last 6-7 years since the great financial crisis with slashing interest rates and printing money, China has played that game as well as any other central bank in the world. And they've done that for a number of reasons. One is they have pegged their yuan to the dollar. So what the United States really started the currency devaluations back in 2008, 2009. And since then, pretty much every currency in the world, every nation in the world has devalued their currencies alongside the US dollar. And now we're seeing that these distortions that are created by central banks, they're there. They've happened. They're built into the cake. We've had zero interest rates for 7 years. I mean, there are consequences to that. And we're seeing that China is one of the wonder boys of the last decade or so. They've grown the fastest. And because of that, they've had a lot of speculation as well. They've had a lot of, you know, bubbles that are developed in their economy too. And they are prone to having, you know, these economic distortions. I think we're seeing some of those corrections now. Those corrections need to happen. You need to wipe out the bad investments. You need to write off bad debts, things like that. And that's happening in China. But just to put this in context, as bad as China's market meltdown has been over the last week, you know, down 16%, something like that. If you look at where they're at, their market levels, the Shanghai index, is probably still where it was back in 2013. So it's maybe fallen back 2 years worth of progress. So this,
where would we put, say, these other, the Dow, the DAX, the FTSE, where do these fit? When you have, say, a response to that kind of contraction in China, how much of a setback is that? You mentioned trillions of dollars lost in these markets.
Right, trillions of dollars lost. The markets in the United States are still significantly bigger than the markets in China, for example. But you take a look at the European markets, they're comparable to the U.S. market in scale. So you're starting with a bigger number. So the losses on a percent when you lose a certain percent are going to be greater. But, you know, we're sitting at the Dow now in the 16,000s, 17,000 going up and down in that range. We've blown off several years of advancement and growth as well. During this downturn.
So what do we think is going to happen next, just looking at the situation as it is and what the market has told us here over the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, well, there's something very interesting happening in China right now. If you take a look at China's yuan, its currency, there it's not freely floatable. It's not freely tradable around this world. And what we're seeing is the price for yuan.
What do you mean by that?
Right, so the Chinese yuan isn't freely exchangeable. You can't just go to your bank and say, I want to buy a whole bunch of Chinese yuan. And basically, everything is controlled by the Chinese central bank, the Politburo in China. They have controls on their currency. So it doesn't float freely in world markets. And because of that, we're seeing basically a dichotomy between what a yuan trades for in China and what it trades for outside of Chinese authorities on the international scene. And what we're seeing is speculators, investors, seem to be pricing in a pretty big devaluation of the Chinese currency. So what the yuan is trading for outside of China is less than what it's trading for officially inside of China. So, I mean, if a person had free access to markets, they could buy yuan super cheap on the international scale, go into China and exchange them, you know, at that rate, and you become a zillionaire. But that's because governments, you know, they have capital controls. They aren't letting the markets equilibrate. So traders seem to be thinking we're going to have another devaluation coming from China. And this could be big news because, as you remember, back in August when they had their biggest devaluation in their history against the dollar, that set off alarm bells in Washington. A lot of policymakers, politicians said, hey, our companies are competing against Chinese companies. And if they're devaluing their currency, that's giving them an unfair advantage, right? Trade war, currency wars. And a lot of Asian nations too saw what China did and said, hey, are you planning on doing more of this? Or, you know, what's going on here? Because if you want to play this game, we can play this game too. We can start devaluing. And then nobody wins. It's a zero-sum game. If everybody's devaluing, nobody's going to win. So policymakers don't want that because, I mean, then you start having inflation and all kinds of trouble coming out of this. Not good for the global economy, not good for jobs or anything like that. But we are seeing this dichotomy. And so traders seem to think that China is going to devalue again. And the yuan has been falling in value. And some people have been talking about it, not in terms of a devaluation, but in terms of an intentional devaluation, but in terms of market forces, because China has been trying to liberalize its markets and they have been letting it float a little bit on its own within a range. So that's the next thing to watch for, in my opinion. China's economy is slowing. They have a lot of social pressures, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on the government to make sure that their economy is still growing. They're still producing the jobs that they need to for the people in there, because internally, China has a lot of stresses, and they aren't as stable as, I think, a lot of Western nations in that regard.
Chinese market's not necessarily something that a whole lot of people are going to put a whole lot of interest in, but the last week shows us, yes, this has a huge effect, and what happens in China really can impact everybody and impact the entire global economy. So changes there really should be at the top of our watch list.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at what's going on in Illinois, for example, they're teaching their pension plans, retirement plans for teachers, for government workers, massively underwater after this last week of markets dropping, which are triggered in China. I mean, they're going to be even further underwater. So yeah, people's retirements, wealth generation in this nation, companies being able to access capital, borrowing money, all of this is linked together to what's going on in China today. So big implications.
Well, we're putting this together for an article on thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that in the next few days. Robert, thanks for helping us to understand what's going on here and how this really is something that will impact our lives.
You're welcome. Happy to come in.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Bad blood between Saudi Arabia and Iran is getting worse. Headlines are filling the news about provocations and responses between these two powerhouses of the Middle East. It's really a fight for supremacy in the region. Most recently, this past weekend, Pakistan got involved in this fight. Pakistan's army chief visited Saudi Arabia's defense minister. And what did he say? He said any Iranian threat to Saudi Arabia's territorial integrity will wipe Iran off the map. I have trumpet writer Brent Noctegal here to discuss this remarkable, developing, complex situation in the Middle East. How are you doing, Brent?
Very good.
So we've talked about this on recent programs. First of all, maybe you could just bring us up to speed on this sequence of aggravations that we've seen between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Yeah, it gets back to this current series of aggravations and tit-for-tat type of actions to the past couple of weeks. And it started out when Saudi Arabia decided to put to death 43 of its own people. But one of those 43 that they executed was a Shiite sheikh from northeastern Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is a Sunni Islamic country. 90% of the population is Sunni, and it only has 10% of its population that belongs to the Shiite sect. And it was putting him to death for a number of grievances, as he tried to, in the past few years, lead an insurrection against the government, stoke sectarian tensions inside Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia saw him as one of Iran's agent inside Saudi Arabia, Iran being the chief Shiite nation in the world. Most of its population is Shiite. So you had that taking place, and Iran was very upset that their guy in Saudi Arabia was put to death. I mean, he was imprisoned 2 years earlier. He was in death row. But Saudi Arabia chose the timing of this for a number of different reasons, I think. But immediately after that, we had the storming of Saudi Arabia's embassy inside Tehran. And Iran's a police state. Nothing happens inside Iran really without the Iranian government at least allowing it or turning a blind eye to it. So it wasn't the Iranian military overrunning the embassy. It was just protesting the sheikh's death. The Iranian police force basically stood down and let them, you know, burn the embassy and another one of its consulates elsewhere in Iran. Now, following that action, the day after, I think we're going back a week and a half now. We had a cascade of different states, Arab states, that came out and supported Saudi Arabia by cutting off diplomatic ties with Iran. There was a number of Gulf states that did this. You had Sudan doing this as well. You had even Pakistan deciding to limit its relations with Iran. Turkey, while they didn't, you know, they don't really want to get embroiled in this too much, they too expressed displeasure with Iran as well. So you had a number of, I think there's probably five or six states that actually cut off, sent their ambassadors back home, and they said, we're not going to have any diplomatic relations with Iran anymore. And that's the basic back and forth that's gone on. And then responding from that, Iran has had a lot of nasty things to say about Saudi Arabia, blaming them for most of the Middle East distress right now that's taking hold on a number of different countries. They're talking about their proxy involvement inside Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, blaming the Saudis for all of these things. Obviously, the Saudis believe Iran is at fault, that they're motivating this. But the most recent story, as you said, and the most recent retaliatory comment comes after the defense minister, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, visited with the military leader of Pakistan and shoring up what looks to be a nuclear alliance where the only Arab state with a nuclear bomb right now is Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And they're mainly a Sunni state. And it looks like Pakistan's coming out in support of Saudi Arabia in this dispute.
Well, the other thing that I guess you could kind of add to this is that hastily cobbled together alliance that Saudi Arabia was trying to put together a few weeks ago. And it's essentially an anti-Iranian alliance, or it appears to be that. But this is really, it seems like Saudi Arabia is acting with some real desperation here. What is it that they're so threatened by with respect to Iran?
Right. Now, these have been the latest. We just talked about the latest back and forth between Iran and the Saudis. But you have to look back a couple of years to see when Saudi Arabia started to get really upset and realize what Iran was trying to do. This is coming at the same time where the United States is shifting its alliance away from its traditional ally in Saudi Arabia against Iran to Iran. And Saudi Arabia has seen this for a number of years, and they've gradually been trying to shore up alliances with different states to replace the United States in order to counter Iran. And like you said, we've had the dramatic news that they were going to form a military alliance with different Arab states all over the world, that they said they're going to combat terrorism wherever it could be found. And at the start, people were praising this, even though they might not have thought it was going to come to much, that at least you had Saudi Arabia that was going to come and fight the Islamic State. You've had a lot of people blaming Saudi Arabia, since the Islamic State is a Sunni group. They were blaming Saudi Arabia for actually the creation of the Islamic State. So now we finally had Sunnis. It looked like a Sunni alliance was going to come against and fight the Sunni terrorist group, the Islamic State. But they were very specific in their announcement when they announced that alliance, that it was to counter terrorism wherever it could be found. And then most notably, as you said, Iran was missing from the number of countries as part of that list. So we can see that as a way of trying to counter what Iran's doing in a number of different countries. You have a lot of people just seeing this as they're both as evil as one another type thing. They've both got about as much power as one another, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And they, especially because we're in America, it seems like a lot of the American press are biting into that theory and agreeing with it to a certain extent. Saudi Arabia's evil.
It's essentially a balance of power.
Right.
More akin to what we saw with Iran and Iraq before the United States eliminated Iraq from the picture. And these guys are just let them go at it.
Right.
And we can stand back and watch.
Right. But there's been a number of commentators that are quite smart that have come out and said, no, there will be a winner in this. The reason, you know, that Iraq did check Iran for a long time, didn't let them grow. And that did end up in war. But at the end of it, you did have the overarching power of the United States still in the region. And back then in that war, you actually had Saudi Arabia and Iran fighting on the same side against Saddam Hussein. So this isn't just a purely sectarian thing. I mean, Shiites and Sunnis have been fighting for years. But 30 years ago, Iran and Saudi Arabia, 40 years ago, before the Shah was overthrown, they were friends.
Other considerations took precedence.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's the case right now as well. I don't think Saudi Arabia is necessarily wanting to be against Iran just because they're a Shiite state. They're against Iran because they've seen a number of Iranian moves over the past 3 years that are leading it to know and leading them to have the understanding that Iran is trying to take over the Middle East.
Yeah.
And they know they are, it looks like, the strongest state against Iranian moves in the Middle East right now. I mean, Egypt used to be very big at checking Iran's power. Egyptian government's unstable. That's being funded a lot by the Saudis right now. So that they see themselves as the player that has to stand up to Iran's ambitions.
Right. It's really interesting to look at this, as you mentioned, as a response to America's change. First of all, withdrawal generally from the region, really turning our back on this historic alliance with Saudi Arabia and throwing our weight behind Iran. As much as President Obama wants to talk about this nuclear deal as being something that's going to check Iran, Saudi Arabia sees the reality of the situation, this has given a huge boost to Iran. And everything that Iran has done since this deal shows that it knows that it holds all the cards. I mean, it had this provocation against a U.S. warship just last week where it's basically acting with impunity.
Right.
Saudi Arabia sees it.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia sees it. And, you know, this, if you want to upset the Middle East balance of power, that's what you should do. You should start, switch your alliance, go back the other power. And I think that, you know, the United States is calling on Saudi Arabia to diffuse tensions and not do things that promote this type of tension between themselves and Iran. But Saudi Arabia has been backed into a corner precisely because of the policy of the United States. And we could talk about the failing Saudi Arabian economy right now because of the oil price as well. It's around $31 a barrel, historic lows. Saudi Arabia is funded, most of its government's funded, is from oil. And yet they realize that they don't really have too much control over the price of oil anymore. So they're not getting a lot of funds. I mean, it looks like their treasury is going to be to run out in the next couple of years because of the deficits that their government is putting up each year to try and just stay afloat. So they're going to get more desperate as time goes on. Why are they lacking money? What are they spending it on? They're spending it on defense. They're spending it on propping up the other Gulf states as part of the anti-Iran alliance. They're propping up Egypt, like I said before. They're fighting a ground war in Yemen. All these things cost money, and they have to do all these things to counter Iran. All of them. Yes, the oil price is low, but their expenditures are even greater right now because they've got to check Iran.
A lot of pressure on Saudi Arabia. It's interesting to look at this list of states that it's trying to kind of rally to this cause. I mean, Pakistan is interesting. Certainly, it's very important from a nuclear standpoint. We've never really said definitively, as far as I know, from a biblical prophecy standpoint, what direction Pakistan would go. It's not hard to see how they would cast their lot in with more of a Middle East rather than an Asian alliance. But it is interesting looking at this list of states that are coming together, because we've talked a lot about this alliance that's prophesied in Psalm 83. Saudi Arabia is right at the center of it. It also draws Germany into to that alliance. Germany obviously feeling pressure from and wanting to counter Iranian hegemony and the spread of its power throughout the region. So there's a real confluence of factors happening right here that are really aligning exactly with what we've been expecting to.
Right, they are, especially with that alliance that we saw Saudi Arabia cobbling together. But it is interesting to watch what Pakistan does in this situation. Like I said, they're about half Shiite, half Sunni. The only way I think they would end up siding with Iran is if there was some type of regime change inside Pakistan. And you know, that could happen. It's basically a failed state with nuclear bombs. And that's what Carolyn Glick's comment or editorial in Jerusalem Post is about yesterday. And I could see definitely them staying with the Saudis, just because we know end time prophecy looks like that Psalm 83 alliance is going to be allied with a German power that does want to encircle the king of the south led by Iran. And, you know, Pakistan could play a key part in that. They're just on the eastern side of, they share the eastern border with Iran. We already have European troops inside Afghanistan as well. So if they're going to circle around the king of the south, like we know is going to happen from Daniel 11:40, then we could see Pakistan falling right in line in this Psalm 83 alliance.
Very interesting to watch this develop. And we'll definitely have to keep our eyes focused on how this develops, because it is so central to really two or three biblical prophecies that we focus a lot of attention on. We're watching it unfold before our eyes. It's very, very fascinating to see it develop. Thanks for bringing us up to speed on these things, Brent.
No problem. It's good to be here.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Bread, it is the staff of life. It's been a major staple of the human diet for thousands of years. It's still the most regularly consumed food in the world, but it's been getting a lot of bad press lately. There's a lot of talk about the problems with carbohydrates, with gluten. Should your diet include white bread, whole grain bread, or no bread? I have with me Jorg Mardian, a registered holistic nutritionist, via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
Appreciate you coming on. So what are some of the problems associated with good old white bread?
Well, it's hard to know where to start there. White bread is basically, white bread is a poison to the body, and white bread has been a staple of industrial society for quite a long time. And it's just something that shouldn't be in our diet. And it's been proven now by countless studies to give us all kinds of health problems. And in large part, the obesity crisis that we're seeing today has to do with refined carbohydrates. And it's not just in breads, but in all commercial products that we consume, because it's just added on as thickeners, and refined carbohydrates are just a way to cheaply add onto a product. And it's an intriguing subject, because today, carbohydrates in general are really vilified as a subject of weight gain. And that's not really fair, because it's an incomplete way to look at that. We're looking at something that's a refined product rather than looking at a whole product. And so we're really missing the boat on what's going on in the body. We're looking at it as a weight gain issue rather than as a nutrition issue and as a source of energy for the body. So I think we have to be careful of half-truths, of extremes, and even misinformation about what carbohydrates really are for the body. The study that we looked at concerning this is from the International Life Sciences Institute. And this study was purposely undertaken to study the relationship between bread consumption, body weight, and abdominal fat distribution, because the scientists said there's a longstanding belief by the public that bread fattens. And is that true? Well, they know that it encourages many people to restrict or even eliminate bread from their diet because of this belief. Now, the results indicate that dietary patterns that include whole grain breads, whole, that means the entire grain, do not cause weight gain. This is scientific proof. This is absolute.
So bread in and of itself, it's gotten a bad rep, but you're saying certain kinds of bread aren't necessarily going to create the problems that we tend to associate it with it.
That's correct. If we look at the science, if we look at how scientists look at things, we have to take those and say, well, they've done the studies, and the studies contradict what athletes and what movie stars and even some health authors say. So what's going on? Why is there a contradiction? And this is where people get stuck.
Right. A lot of times it feels like, well, the studies themselves contradict other studies a lot of times, and you're getting conflicting information from different sources, and it's hard to know what's true.
Exactly. Now, and I'd like to address that, because this study showed in regards to refined bread versus whole grain bread. And they used two types of studies. They studied the weaker cross-sectional type of studies, which indicate a beneficial result of refined grains. But these are not, these are observational studies only, and they're not considered high quality. So I wouldn't even look at those. The other part of this study, which took all these studies together, was used with well-designed and higher quality cohort studies. And these demonstrate a relationship with excess abdominal fat using refined grains. So I'm not sure why the authors, they did say they had some confusion as to whether refined grains were bad for us or not. I'm not sure why that is, because the high quality cohort studies absolutely show there is, and the lower quality studies show there isn't. So I don't put much stock in observational studies. I would look at the higher quality studies. However, in relation to whole grains, there's no doubt. All the studies show that whole grains do not lead to weight gain, but with the caveat that we shouldn't overeat them.
Okay, but maybe before we get into specific prescriptions, you could just explain to us a little the difference between the distinction that you're making between refined grains and whole grains.
Sure. When you're buying a bread, the first ingredient you should look at is the wheat portion. If it says 100% whole wheat or 100% whole grain, this would indicate to you that all three parts of the grain kernel, that means the bran, which is the outer layer, the germ, and the endosperm, that's the inside of the grain, which is mainly the starch portion, are included. Now, that's a nutritious grain. If it doesn't say 100% whole, you're not getting that. And the labeling today is quite specific, and people are really buying into this. They're looking for the 100% whole grain label, and that's the nutritious part of it, and that's what keeps us healthy.
And the refining that process that you're talking about, it's stripping out some of those elements, and it's that refining that really creates the problems. Do you know why that would be?
Absolutely, because the refining, once that hits the bloodstream, and carbohydrates are really just a source of energy, glucose to the body, and we do need them. But when we strip the grain, what we're stripping is a lot of the nutrients, a lot of the fiber that the body needs and it just kind of carpet bombs our body, gets into that blood way too fast, and then we start having problems with blood sugar going up too high and then sinking, and it just creating this feeling that we're tired immediately, you know, shortly afterwards. And as well, in the long term, as we keep eating these refined grains, it just adds excess weight to our body, especially the abdomen. And that, the scientists are saying, isn't happening with the whole grain, because the whole grain is absorbed rather slowly. And all the studies, really, they show that. The Journal of Nutrition has done many studies where it shows that there's decreased fat with whole grains, decreased abdominal fat specifically with whole grains, lower BMI. That was a study from Public Health Nutrition. It showed that even the body mass index drops with whole grains. And I mean, I can go on and on. There's lists of what the actual whole grain, the benefits of it. And I can show you studies, or we could talk about studies where refined grains go the other way. So I don't think too many nutritionists would argue the benefits of whole versus refined. That's well known.
We're talking about, say, the quality of the grain that you're ingesting, whether it's refined or whether it's whole, that we ought to, say, if we're looking at the package, we see the ingredients list on a particular product, we want to make sure that it says 100% whole grain. You also made mention of proportion, or, say, the amount that you would consume. What would be some guidelines to look at there?
Well, with my clients, And a lot of people in society today, they're not very active anymore. I mean, that's a fact. The jobs that we have, they have us sitting a lot. And so even if we're consuming whole grains, it's still an energy food. So the body treats it as a sugar, which is fine if we're active. We can consume that in larger portions. But if we're not active, then if we consume too many grains as well, they're very easy to make, like sandwiches or wraps or such, and we could eat them morning, night, morning, noon, and night. But we shouldn't do that because we're not burning that grain off either. So even too much of a good thing without exercise to burn that off will be detrimental to the body. So we really have to look at making sure that we have a good diet, which includes other foods, proteins, good quality proteins, vegetables, healthy fats and such, and then include a moderate portion of grains into that, as well as an active lifestyle to balance the body. If we're not active and we're just eating, well, that's not moderation either, because then we have to reduce what we eat because we're not active. An athlete would be able to eat much more. Sports science tells us that some athletes, swimmers per se, can take in up to 10,000 calories a day, and they're still slim. Mm-hmm. Well, try that sitting at your desk. It wouldn't work. And so we have to reduce what we eat if we're not active, even if it is good grains.
Okay, so any, say, specific prescriptions? You're talking about, say, balancing grain consumption with quality protein and vegetables and other, say, simple carbohydrate type foods. What would we be looking at in terms of optimal proportions or just portions?
Well, if a person is already overweight, then I always assume that they're eating too many carbohydrates. I mean, that's 95% of people that sit across from me. That's what it is. So I reduce the carbohydrate amounts to smaller amounts. So I say, look, if you're looking at your plate, have a good portion of clean protein in front of you, lots of vegetables, but make sure your carbohydrates are no more than a third of that plate. So if I go out in a restaurant, I might even have somebody who's really struggling with weight just to look at the front of their fist and say, keep it to that amount for the time being until you reduce that weight. If a person has a normal weight, then a third of the plate is a good portion, as long as that grain is whole. So rice should be brown rice. Bread should be whole. You know, even in restaurants, we should take care to ask for those types of grains and portions. And they will do so because we're the consumers and we ask for that. As well, I wanted to say in relation to breads, because we are talking about breads, we have to be careful of commercial because The way that they prepared far too quick today, and that really binds up a lot of the nutrients. A good way to eat breads is soaked, sprouted, or sourdough grains. These are properly prepared, and we can ask for those at bakeries, and we can even get those in the grocery stores. Some examples of those would be Food for Life 7 sprouted grains, and you'll see that in the title. It'll say sprouted or sourdough. Mm-hmm. Ezekiel 4-9 bread, that's a really good commercial bread. Trader Joe's, those type of breads, I mean, they're available to us. We just have to look a little bit. And the more the consumer asks, the more they're going to be available to them. But if we're just going to take a bread and say, look, this is whole grain, and we're not looking at the back of the ingredients, we're going to be hit with one other thing, which really is damaging to us. And that's the additives. Now, additives, even in breads pretending to be healthy, may include emulsifiers, softeners, dough straighteners, relaxers, conditioners, even GMO emulsifiers or preservatives. It really is what I call a murderous row of chemicals, and they lead to all kinds of disease, even colitis and Crohn's disease, obesity. Chemicals are known as well to cause weight gain. Look for bread with a short list of ingredients that we recognize, that we can pronounce, and that are healthy.
So soaked grains, sprouted grains, sourdough grains, and avoid the unpronounceable ingredients on the ingredients list.
That's right. It does take some effort. I always tell people, you can't just go in a supermarket and start picking out products that have pretty pictures. That's marketing. Those are 30-year-old marketing gurus that say, what do we want to give those people that looks pretty? We have to engage our mind and look at the back of the package, look at the ingredient list and say, look, now what do we recognize back here? A bread should really not have more than 4 or 5 ingredients unless they're all recognizable and healthy. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's not just looking for the refined versus unrefined, it's also looking at the additives and the chemicals in it, and as well as looking at the portions. So if we're sedentary, it's important to watch the portion sizes when incorporating those into a healthy diet. You have to monitor total diet and lifestyle together. Some type of exercise should be in your week, and then you should eat moderate amounts of soaked, sprouted, or sourdough grains in a diet rich with fruits, vegetables, beans, fish, olive oil, and other healthy foods. Making those choices keeps your health for later on.
All right, great stuff. We've been talking with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about bread. He's written an article for thetrumpet.com called "Is Bread Still the Staff of Life?" We sure appreciate you helping us to make sense of this sometimes confusing subject. Thanks a lot, Jörg.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Life is a journey of millions of small steps. It's a lot of tiny choices that lead to either good or ill. But the steps are so small and so many that usually we're careless about the step we're taking. It's no big deal, just one little decision, just one step. But how life-changing a single step can be. Every step points in a direction. One step leads to more steps. It leads away from other steps. It can put you on a different path. One step can determine failure or success. It can mean life or death. Both sin and righteousness start with one step. According to the Bible, Lucifer's attempt to dethrone God started with one step. His sin began when he momentarily harbored an attitude of self-love, and then he allowed vanity to lead to self-righteousness, to a sense of entitlement, to resentment, to bitterness, to hostility, step by step down a dark path. Then he spread his attitude. He persuaded and seduced one angel here, two there. Discussion begat dissension. which bred insubordination, which became defiance, which burst into mutiny, revolt, and warfare. This sequence of steps turned the Lightbringer into the adversary, and it turned millions of brilliant, fiery angels into demons. As with Lucifer, so with us. Sin always starts in the mind. We conceive it, we mull it, it grows, and it bursts into a sinful act, which leads to death. A terrible bad habit starts with one decision to take the easy route. Debt and bankruptcy trace back to the first ill-advised purchase. A broken friendship begins with a single hurtful comment. A bad marriage stems from one unhealthy secret kept from a spouse. That first small step in the direction of sin is always easy to justify. You want to do something that you know you shouldn't. You think that going just part way won't do any harm. But the reality is, every step down that path leads to more steps into sin. That's why God considers that first step already committing the act spiritually, according to the spirit or intent of the law. When we take that first step, in God's eyes, we're already guilty. He recognizes where that first small step leads. That's why he commands in 1 Corinthians 6 that we flee fornication rather than flirt with it. Take steps in the opposite direction rather than getting close to it. The writer of Psalm 119 wrote that God's word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. God's way of life is a narrow path, and we need that light to guide us and to keep us on the path. If you take a step or two off that path, you're in the dark. And if you don't get back on quickly, well, that lamp can move on. It's important when we recognize that we've taken a misstep to repent immediately and get back on that lighted path right away. The good things we want in life also come step at a time. Just as small steps can take you off the path, small steps also carry you forward to your goal. The Israelites made it from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land one step at a time. The potential that God has given to human beings is tremendous. The calling of a Christian is awesome, almost too awesome to comprehend, but we fulfill that calling through small daily steps. Prayer, study, work, time management, taking care of our body, our mind, our family, our relationships, our possessions. However overwhelming any given objective may seem, recognize the power in using right now to take one step toward that objective. Savings in the bank can start with a dollar. A healthy diet can start with one resisted temptation. A close friendship can start with a single compliment. Force yourself to do the first small thing, and you've started moving in the right direction. God tells us to be attentive to our every step in Proverbs 4, verses 25 through 27. It says, "Let your eyes look right on, and let your eyelids look straight before you. Ponder the path of your feet, and let all your ways be established. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. Remove your foot from evil." So whatever your next step, recognize the power of that simple, everyday choice you're about to make. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of The Trumpet Magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where to find the stories that we've talked about on the program today, and where you can also go to get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Brent Noctegal, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Oliver Wendell Holmes. Trouble creates a capacity to handle it. I don't embrace trouble. That's as bad as treating it as an enemy. But I do say, meet it as a friend. For you'll see a lot of it, and had better be on speaking terms with it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.